apparitions beckon, and your fear is a warning. It's nightfall. Good evening, dear friends. Frederick Hent, your fellow traveler on tonight's quest for facts. A lonely outpost, a monotonous job. Just the sort of thing that can lead to strange flights of fancy or to strange events, in fact. In this evening's story, The Signalman by Charles Dickens, adapted for Nightfall by Otto Lowy, we are drawn down an irrevocable path to the truth. Pay close attention to detail and you might avoid disaster. Listen.
When he heard a voice thus calling him, he was standing at the door of his box, a flag in his hand pulled around its short pole. One would have thought, considering the nature of the ground, that he could not have doubted from what quarter the voice came. But instead of looking up to where I stood on the top of the steep cutting nearly over his head, he turned himself about and looked down the line. There was something remarkable in his manner of doing so, though I could not for my life have said what. But I know it was remarkable enough to attract my notice, even though the figure was foreshortened and shadowed down in the deep trench, and mine was high above him, so steeped in the glow of an angry sunset that I shaded my eyes with my hand before I saw him at all.
By which I can come down and speak to you.
He looked up at me without replying, and I looked down at him without pressing him too soon with an idle repetition of my idle question. A rapid train passed below me and was skimming away over the landscape. When the vapor disappeared, I looked down again and saw him refurling the flag he had shown while the train went by.
I say I want to come down and speak to you. Over there! The path! All right, I'm coming down.
Looking closely about me, I found a rough zigzag descending path notched out, which I followed. The cutting was extremely deep and unusually precipitous. It was made through a clammy stone that became oozier and wetter as I went down. For these reasons, I found the way long enough to give me time to recall the singular air of reluctance or compulsion with which he had pointed out the path. When I came down low enough on the zigzag descent to see him again, I saw that he was standing between the rails on the way by which the train had lately passed. His attitude was one of such expectation and watchfulness that I stopped a moment, wondering at it. I resumed my downward way and, stepping out upon the level of the railroad, drew nearer to him. He was a dark, sallow man with a dark head and rather heavy eyebrows. His post was in as solitary and dismal place as I ever saw. On either side, a dripping wet wall of jagged stone, excluding all view but a strip of sky. The perspective one way, only a crooked prolongation of this great dungeon. The shorter perspective in the other direction, terminating in a gloomy red light, and the gloomier entrance into a black tunnel in whose massive architecture there was a barbarous, depressing, and forbidding air. So little sunlight ever found its way to this spot that it had an earthy, deadly smell. And so much cold wind rushed through it that it struck chill to me as if I had left the natural world. Before he stirred, I was near enough to him to have touched him. Not even then, removing his eyes from mine, he stepped back one step and lifted his hand. This is a very lonesome post to occupy.
Yes, it is.
A visitor is a rarity, I suppose.
Yes, indeed.
Not an unwelcome rarity, I hope. I've been shut up within narrow limits all my life, and it is only recently that I've become interested in these great works, the railroads, for instance. That's why I spoke to you. It's all very interesting. Is that red light part of your charge?
Don't you know it is?
No, I don't. You look at me as if you had a dread of me.
I was doubtful whether I had seen you before.
Where?
There.
There? At that... that red light?
Yes.
My dear fellow, what would I do there? However, be that as it may, I never was there, you may swear.
I think I may. Yes. Yes, I'm sure I may.
Have you much to do here?
Yes. I suppose I have enough responsibility to bear.
Responsibility?
You might call it that, sir. It's exactness and watchfulness that's required of me. No manual labor to speak of.
What are your duties, if I might inquire?
Well, sir, change that signal, turn those lights, and turn this iron handle now and then.
They must be long and lonely hours at times.
I've grown used to them, sir.
Is it necessary for you when on duty always to remain in that channel of damp air? Can you never come up into the sunshine from between these high stone walls?
That depends on times and circumstances.
Times? Circumstances?
Yes, sir. Under some conditions, there would be less upon the line than under others. And the same holds true to certain hours of the day and night. And in very bright weather, I do choose occasions for getting a little above these lower shadows. But then I'm always liable to be called by the electric bell, and I have to keep on listening for it.
That means, of course, that the relief would be less than one would suppose.
Yes, sir. Exactly that. But come now, sir. Come with me.
He took me into his box where there was a fire, a desk for an official book in which he had to make certain entries, and a telegraphic instrument with its dial, face, and needles.
Excuse me, sir. A message, I believe.
I trust that you'll excuse the remark, but you seem to be well educated. Perhaps educated above your present station. I hope I might say this without offense.
Not at all, sir. Well, I liked to read early in my life. I was even something of a student of natural philosophy, and I attended lectures. But then I started to run wild, misused my opportunities, gone down, never to rise again.
I'm sorry.
I have no complaint to offer about that, sir. I've made my bed, and I have to lie upon it. It's far too late to make another. Excuse me, sir. I hope to see the train go by.
I should have set this man down as one of the safest of men to be employed in his capacity, but for the circumstance that while he was talking to me, he twice broke off with a fallen collar, turned his face towards the little bell when it did not ring, opened the door of the hut, and looked out towards the red light near the mouth of the tunnel. On both of those occasions, he came back to the fire with an inexplicable air upon him.
You almost make me think that I have met with a contented man.
I believe I used to be so, but I am troubled.
With what? What is your trouble?
It's very difficult to impart, sir. If you ever make me another visit, I will try to tell you.
But I expressly intend to make you another visit. Say, when shall it be?
I go off early in the morning, and I shall be on again at 10 o'clock tomorrow night, sir.
I will come at 11.
I'll show my white light, sir, till you've found the way up. When you have found it, don't call out. And when you're at the top, don't call out.
Very well.
And when you come down tomorrow night, don't call out.
Very well.
Let me ask you a parting question. Tonight, what made you cry hello below there?
Heaven knows I cried something to that effect.
Not to that effect, sir. Those were the very words. I know them well.
I admit those were the very words. I said them, no doubt, because I saw you below.
For no other reason?
What other reason could I possibly have?
You had no feeling that they were conveyed to you in a supernatural way?
No, indeed, no. With this, he wished me good night and held up his light. I walked by the side of the down line of rails with a very disagreeable sensation of a train coming behind me until I found a path. It was easier to mount than descend, and I got back to my inn without any adventure. Next night, punctual to my appointment, I placed my foot on the first notch of the zigzag as the distant clocks were striking 11. He was waiting for me at the bottom with his white light on.
I have not called.
May I speak now?
By all means, sir.
Good evening, then, and here's my hand.
Good evening, sir, and here's mine.
With that, we walked side by side to his box, entered it, closed the door, and sat by the fire. He began bending forward as soon as we were seated to speak in a tone but a little above a whisper.
I have made up my mind, sir, that you shall not have to ask me twice what troubled me. I took you for someone else yesterday evening. That troubles me.
Who is it?
I don't know.
Like me?
I don't know. I never saw the face. The left arm is across the face, and the right arm is waved, violently waved, this way.
I followed the action with my eyes, and it was the action of an arm gesticulating with the utmost passion and vehemence. For God's sake, clear the way.
One moonlight night, I was sitting here when I heard a voice cry, "Hello! Below there!" I started up, I looked from that door, and I saw that someone else standing by the red light near the tunnel, waving as I just now showed you. The voice seemed hoarse with shouting, and it cried, "Look out! Look out!" And then again, "Hello! Below there! Look out!" I caught up my lamp, turned it on red, and ran towards the figure, calling, "What's wrong? What has happened? Where?" It just stood outside the blackness of the tunnel. I advanced so close upon it that I wondered at its keeping the sleeve across its eyes. I ran right up to it and had my hand stretched out to pull the sleeve away when it was gone.
Into the tunnel?
No. I ran into the tunnel 500 yards. I stopped and held my lamp above my head and saw the figures of the measured distance and saw the stains stealing down the walls and trickling through the arch. I ran out again faster than I had run in, for I had a mortal abhorrence of the place upon me. And I looked all around the red light with my own red light. I went up the iron ladder to the gallery atop of it, and I came down again and ran back in here. I telegraphed both ways. An alarm has been given. Is anything wrong? The answer came back both ways. All is well.
But surely, in that case, this figure must have been a deception of your sense of sight. It might have originated in some temporary disease of the delicate nerves that minister to the functions of the eye.
Within 6 hours after the appearance, the remarkable accident on this line happened. And within 10 hours, the dead and the wounded were being brought along through the tunnel over the spot where the figure had stood.
It is not to be denied that this was a remarkable coincidence, calculated deeply to impress your mind. But it is unquestionable that remarkable coincidences do continually occur, and they must be taken into account.
This was just a year ago. 6 or 7 months passed, and I'd recovered from the surprise and shock when, one morning, as day was breaking, standing in the door, I looked towards the red light and saw the spectre again.
Did it cry out?
No. It was silent.
Did it wave its arm?
No. It leaned against the shaft of the light with both hands before the face.
Did you go up to it?
I came in and sat down, partly to collect my thoughts, partly because it had turned me faint. When I went to the door again, daylight was above me, and the ghost was gone.
But nothing followed? Nothing came of this?
That very day, as a train came out of the tunnel, I noticed at a carriage window on my side what looked like a confusion of hands and heads, and something waved. I saw it just in time to signal the driver, stop. He shut off and put his brake on. Well, the train drifted past here 100 yards or more. I ran after it, and as I went along, I heard terrible screams and cries. A beautiful young lady had died instantly in one of the compartments and was brought in here and laid down on the floor between us.
Here?
True, sir. True. Precisely as it happened, so I tell it to you. Now, sir, mark this and judge how my mind is troubled. The spectre came back a week ago. Ever since, it has been there now and again by fits and starts.
And the light?
At the danger light.
What does it seem to do?
It seems to say, with its hands, for God's sake, clear the way. I have no peace or rest for it. It calls to me for many minutes together in an agonized manner. Below there! Look out! Look out! It stands waving to me. It rings my little bell.
Did it ring your bell yesterday evening when I was here and you went to the door?
Twice.
Why, see how your imagination misleads you. My eyes were on the bell and my ears were open to the bell. And if I am a living man, it did not ring at those times. No, nor at any other time, except when it was rung in the natural course of physical things by the station communicating with you.
I have never made a mistake as to that yet, sir. I've never confused the spectre's rings with the man's. The ghost's ring is a strange vibration in the bell that it derives from nothing else. And I've not asserted that the bell stirs to the eye. I don't wonder that you fail to hear, but I heard it.
And did the spectre seem to be there when you looked out?
It was there.
Both times?
Both times.
Will you come to the door with me and look for it now?
I will, sir.
Do you see it now?
No. It is not there.
Agreed.
But I've seen it, sir. I've seen it. Therefore, you will fully understand, sir, that what troubles me so dreadfully is the question, what does the spectre mean?
I'm not certain that I do fully understand.
What is it warning against? What is the danger? Where is the danger? There is danger overhanging somewhere on the line. Some dreadful calamity will happen. It's not to be doubted this third time after what has gone before. Surely this is a cruel haunting of me. What can I do?
It is a difficult question to answer, indeed.
If I telegraph danger on either side of me, or on both, I can give no reason for it. I should get into trouble and do no good. They would think I was mad.
His pain of mind was most pitiable to see. It was the mental torture of a conscientious man, oppressed beyond endurance by an unintelligible responsibility involving life.
When it first stood under the danger light, why not tell me where that accident was to happen, if it must happen? Why not tell me how it could be averted, if it could be averted? When on its second coming it hid its face, why not tell me instead she's going to die and let them keep her at home? If it came on those two occasions only to show me that its warnings were true, and so prepare me for the third, why not warn me plainly now? And I, Lord help me, a mere poor signalman on this solitary station. Why not go to somebody with credit to be believed and with power to act?
I cannot answer your question. If it will help you to compose your mind, all I can say to you, let it be a comfort to you that you understand your duty, though you do not understand these confounding appearances. But if you like, I'll stay with you through the night. He would not hear of that. The occupations incidental to his post as the night advanced began to make larger demands on his attention, and so I left him at 2 in the morning. That I more than once looked back at the red light as I ascended the path, that I did not like the red light, and that I should have slept but poorly if my bed had been under it, I see no reason to conceal. Nor did I like the two sequences of the accident and the dead girl. But what ran most in my thoughts was the consideration, how ought I to act, having become the recipient of this disclosure? I had proved the man to be intelligent, vigilant, painstaking, and exact. But how long might he remain so in his state of mind? Next evening was a lovely evening, and I walked out to enjoy it. The sun was not quite down when I traversed the field path near the top of the deep cutting. I stepped to the brink and mechanically looked down from the point from which I had first seen him. I cannot describe the chill that seized upon me when, close at the mouth of the tunnel, I saw the appearance of a man with his left sleeve across his eyes, passionately waving his right arm.
The nameless horror that oppressed me passed, and in a moment I saw that this appearance of a man was a man indeed, and that there was a little group of other men standing about. I descended the notched path with all the speed I could make and then spoke to one of the group of men.
What is the matter?
Signalman killed this morning, sir.
Not the man belonging to that box?
Yes, sir.
Well, not the man I know.
Oh, you'll recognize him, sir, if you knew him, for his face is quite composed.
Oh, how did this happen? How did this happen?
He was cut down by an engine, sir. No man in England knew his work better. But somehow, he was not clear of the outer rail. It was just a broad day. He'd struck the light and had the lamp in his hand. As the engine came out of the tunnel, his back was towards him, she cut him down. This man here drove her. Show the gentleman how it happened, Tom.
Yes, show me, please.
Well, coming round the curve in the tunnel, sir, I saw him at the end. Well, like as if I'd seen him down a perspective glass. Well, there's no time to check speed, you see, and I knew him to be very careful. Well, as he didn't seem to take heed to the whistle, I shut it off when we were running down upon him, and I called to him as loud as I could call.
What did you say?
I said, below there, look out! Look out, for God's sake, clear the way!
Oh, my God.
It was a dreadful time it was, sir. I never left off calling to him. I put this arm before my eyes not to see, and I waved this one to the last. But it was no use.
No. No. I suppose it was no use.
When fate calls, there's little that can be done by mortals like you or like me. Here's who was involved in tonight's tale.
The Signalman by Charles Dickens was adapted for radio by Otto Lowy. It featured Leon Pownall as the visitor and Duncan Fraser as the Signalman. The railway worker was played by Desmond Smiley, and William Samples was the engine driver. Technical operation, Jerry Stanley. Sound effects, Chris Cutress. Production assistant, Dagmar Kafanka. The Signalman was produced and directed in Vancouver by Robert Chesterman. Executive producer of Nightfall, Don Kowalczyk. And now a clip from a future Nightfall, Weather Station 4 by Arthur Samuels.
We're into a difficult situation and we're handling it.
There's no cause for panic, not
the
yet, anyway.
The hell there isn't!
We'll...
What if that storm doesn't light up, huh? And that supply plane, what if it doesn't
we'll
get through? What
deal with the ifs as we come to them. Meanwhile, you better try to relax. You'll last longer. Here, pour yourself a cup of tea.
You call that tea? How many times have you used that same stupid tea bag?
Easy, easy, lad. You've got to do the best you can.
Next week... We're giving you a night off. It's Christmas Eve. So we thought you might like to relax on one Friday of the year. But we'll be back the week after with a young man who has a very disturbing love affair with a not very willing lady on Watching by Brian Wade. It's produced and directed by William Lane. Until then, I'm Frederick Hemp for Nightfall.
CBC Radio.